with dads on the air. We're here cause we care. We ask all the questions that others don't dare. We're dads on the air. We're dads on the air.
And welcome back to Dads on the Air, coming to you around Australia on the Community Radio Network. In this program, we bring you informing and entertaining conversations with a wide range of interesting people on topics of fatherhood, family and parenting, men's and boys' issues, and more. Hi, I'm Bill Cable, and our special guest today is Jeff Apter. Jeff is the author of more than 20 music biographies, many of them bestsellers. His subjects include the Bee Gees, the Finn Brothers, and Angus Young of AC/DC. Jeff was on staff at Rolling Stone for several years and has written about the legends, including Bob Dylan and Aretha Franklin. Jeff has also worked on books with soldiers and sports stars. And Jeff was on this program in August 2019 when we talked about his wonderful book about Malcolm Young, the man who made AC/DC. Jeff, welcome back to Dads on the Air.
Bill, good to be back. It's like I've got an annual sport now with you.
I hope so. I really hope so. I'm looking forward to next year's book, whatever that is. But
stay tuned.
You've written books about Angus Young, Malcolm Young, and now George Young. Do you have a special feeling about the Young brothers?
No. I guess I do, but it was sort of, I think the best way to describe it, Bill, is it's an accidental trilogy. I certainly, there's no grand plan to write three books about the three brothers. How it evolved was that a few years ago, I'd asked the publisher whether they'd be interested in a book on Malcolm Young, because I thought he was sort of the background player in AC/DC who probably hadn't got the full recognition for his job steering the ship to, you know, this huge international success that they had. And at the time, it was suggested that Angus was perhaps a better option because he's just a more mainstream figure, I guess, a more accessible character, which I happily agreed to. I'm a working author and I need all the work I can get. But as I finished that and then got the offer to do a book on Malcolm, at the same time the publisher said to me, oh, and we'd also like you to write about George, which for me was a dream come true, because with all due respect to those other books that you mentioned, George's story is more sprawling. It's a bigger story. And he had quite the roller coaster ride over the period of, you know, some 30 years. Malcolm and Angus were very fortunate in so much as the first major band they were involved with became absolutely huge. George didn't have such luck. While he had a great ride for a while with the Easy Beats, there were several years where he was really out in the wasteland, you know, really struggling, hand to mouth. And then to come back, when he came back to Australia in the 70s and worked at Albert's, you know, the House of Hits, it was one of the great comeback stories. And he's got such a huge legacy and a massive influence on the Australian music industry over the past 50 years.
Yes, well, you described Malcolm Young as the man who made AC/DC, but you've described George Young as the man who made Australian rock and roll. So, yeah, I think it's a bigger canvas.
The family have done well, haven't they?
They have, all talented musicians and millionaires, I guess.
Oh, multi.
So, George arrived in Australia with his big family back in 1963 to live in the Villawood Migrant Hostel as a 10-pound pom. I like to think a year later he went to see the Beatles at the Sydney Stadium and they had a big influence on him. Do you think he always wanted to be a rock star?
He certainly had aspirations to be a musician, for sure. He's, even before coming to Australia, his older brother Alex, George was one of eight kids, and there was quite a divide between George, Malcolm and Angus, who were the youngest three, and the other five. So George really looked up to a lot of his older siblings. He had a brother, Alex, who was the only young to stay in the UK. Everybody else immigrated to Australia. By the time that came around, that was 1963, Alex was in a working band. He was a jobbing musician. He was in a band called Grapefruit, who had some success in England in the 60s. And for any band to have success in England in the mid-60s, they're doing well. And he signed to the Apple label, the Beatles label, for a time. So he was quite happy to stay behind. He didn't see any reason to come to Australia, and he stayed in the UK, did well, and was a huge influence on George, I think, and a huge inspiration for him too, as was his older sibling, Margaret, who had great taste in music. The story goes that even when they were living in Glasgow, she'd go down to the docks and pick up records coming off, literally off the boat from the US before they got into the stores and to the radio stations. So she was quite ahead of the curve when it came to R&B and jazz and some early pop and rock records. So she gave George a pretty good musical education. But by the time he got here, I don't think he had any aspirations to be anything else because he didn't know anything else. You know, he hoped, obviously, that there was some kind of career in music, but he came from a family of, you know, his father was a manual labourer who was unemployed when they came out. His mother was a homemaker. They didn't have grand plans for anything beyond just getting by. And at the same time, once the Easy Beats came together at the migrant hostel and saw the Beatles and realised the possibilities there was in writing your own songs and recording them, which was a big moment in Australian musical history because up until then, and this is 64, 65, no one was doing that. The big stars of the time, we're talking, you know, at that time it was Billy Thorpe, Johnny O'Keefe, Cold Joy. I think Normie Rowe was probably moving into the spotlight at that point. They all recorded hits from overseas, but the Easy Beats, with huge help from the Alberts Music Empire, managed to write and record originals, and that was a big thing. So I think George was always looking towards that. I think he wanted to capture what the Beatles were doing, and that was writing their own songs.
Well, when he first arrived in 1963, how would you describe the Australian rock scene at that time?
Non-existent, Bill. I think it's the best way of describing it. Actually, that's not totally fair. I mean, the Johnny O'Keefe heyday had, was receding slightly. If you remember, in the 50s, JOK at the Sydney Stadium was an institution. You know, he'd always be there opening for big international acts and blowing them off the stage with that wild, raucous rock and roll act that he had. But, you know, he wasn't a songwriter, and by the early 60s, things have changed a little bit. Those stars from the 50s, such as Elvis and Bill Haley and Little Richard and Jerry Lee Lewis, they'd all either, in Elvis's case, you know, gone to the army and then disappeared into making bad movies. Jerry Lee Lewis has gotten into a bit of trouble by marrying his cousin. I think Little Richard had found God. You know, they'd all their careers had pretty much stalled, and that momentum of the mid and late 50s had gone. So the charts were full of a lot of crooners, a lot of middle-of-the-road stuff. I think, you know, Acca Bilk, Strangers on the Shore, I think that was a big hit. Frank Ifield was big. It was a pretty bland mix of music, which made the impact of the Beatles and a lot of the other Merseyside bands as well, that British Invasion stuff, absolutely huge because it really shook up what was becoming a very stale and quite, just bland, very vanilla, if you know what I mean. It just had no, there's no life in the charts at the time. It was just very mediocre, middle-of-the-road kind of stuff. And then the Beatles came along to change that, and with the Easy Beats soon after them.
And there was one of those lucky breaks, I guess, in that Villawood migrant hostel when George ran into Harry Vander, as he became, strumming his guitar. They formed the Easy Beats a year later, and it's a strange name, isn't it, in Sports Mad Australia, called the Easy Beats.
Yes, but it's got that misspelling of... Oh, sorry, it's got the Beatles beat, B-E-A-T, which is kind of cool. But you're right, I haven't thought about that. You know, I'm trying to remember... I mean, I was, you know, only a few years old at the time, but certainly as I grew up through the 60s and 70s, an Easy Beat was the team at the bottom of the competition. Mm-hmm. And you certainly couldn't say that about the band. My God. I mean, 50 years later, we're still talking about them, so they did pretty well.
Yeah, look, they had that enormous Beatle-like success in Australia after that first hit, which was, I think, For My Woman. You know, can you describe the scene that when the Easy Beats were playing?
Well, George described it beautifully. He said, we'd get up on stage, we'd shake our bums for 20 minutes, the girls would scream, they'd invade the stage, and we'd have to go running for the stage door and jump in a car. That was essentially an Easy Beats concert. They were rarely completed because of stage invasions and chaos. It was very unsatisfying for George as an aspiring musician and songwriter, very much like the situation the Beatles found themselves in 66, I think, when they said, we can't hear ourselves play. How are we going to grow and mature as musicians if we can't even hear ourselves on stage? And they stopped touring. Well, I think George felt the same kind of distaste, I guess, for that environment. Well, it would have been great for the first 12 months and very exciting. I think after that he grew increasingly weary of it and was more than happy to leave the spotlight to Stevie Wright, who was, if anybody's seen them on stage, he was this absolute human dynamo. You know, it was like watching an aerobics lesson being acted out in front of you. He was incredible. So George was more than happy to stand off to the side and play his guitar. But I just don't think he enjoyed the chaos, and it was always chaos, that ensued at Easy Beat shows. It was pretty mad. Lots of people get hurt, stage invasions. You know, they'd grab the band, they'd try to tear them to pieces. it was really quite frenetic. And I think, like I say, while it would have been fun early on, I'm sure George was just a teenager and all that attention of young females would have been great. It got to a point, I think, where he just probably feared for his own safety and realised it just wasn't very fulfilling for his musical ambitions.
Well, I made the big decision then to go into a bigger pond and go over to England, but leaving Australia proved to be, a disastrous way to end, I suppose, although the plane took off and they didn't crash or anything, but it was pretty frenetic getting out of the country, wasn't it?
Well, and also, yes, that's right, and also the tragedy of Harry Bander. I mean, on the eve of their departure for the UK, you know, with all the support of the country and everybody behind them, and a really exciting time, and they just recorded, I think, two TV specials that were going to air while they were away. Harry came home and his wife had committed suicide. She'd taken an overdose of sleeping pills. Apparently she was distraught. They had a young child. They were only young themselves, barely into their 20s. And Harry was going away for an extended period of time, and she had no idea when he'd be back. And it proved too much for her. And that's just an awful weight. And Harry was devastated, had to send his son back to his family in Holland to be cared for. And George pulled him aside and said to him, "I've got your back. I'm with you. Whatever you need from me, I'm going to be here." Because by that time, initially George was writing songs for Stevie Wright, but he moved to working with Harry now. He could understand that Harry was his creative equal, if you like. He was someone that he could really work with and relate to. And they were really tight. They were really, really good friends. You know, they had that shared experience of being strangers in town at the migrant hostel. And I think they carried a lot of that through the next 50 years of their life because they were lifelong friends. So it was a difficult departure. It really was. Harry was, you know, he was devastated. He was crushed. He'd had this horrible experience. And as you say, there were also some minor technical difficulties, like fans trying to rush onto the plane and aborted flights and so on, and a bomb hoax. You know, it was, if you were looking for portents of doom, I think you would have got off the plane in Perth and gone home, frankly.
Well, one thing you mentioned there about how George said he'd stand with Harry, and I think that's one thing about all those young brothers. They were extremely loyal. If you were brought into that circle, yeah, you had someone for life, I think.
Yeah, that's true. A tough circle to break into, though. They were pretty, I'd say, reclusive, but they were a little insular. They were a little wary of the outside world, which is absolutely understandable given the circumstances from which they came, you know. Prior to the Villawood Migrant Hostel, they'd been raised in the housing estate in Glasgow. It was tough. Their dad was in and out of work. It was eight kids. It was a hard environment to live in. And then to come to Australia expecting, you know, I think the ads at the time were come to the sunny side, and they end up at the Villawood Migrant Hostel in the midst of 6 weeks of constant rain, you know, snakes and spiders and hostile locals. It was a pretty tough upbringing. And I think a lot of that stayed with Malcolm, George and Angus. You know, they retained that kind of almost like a hostel mentality, if you know what I mean. But what you say is true. Once they had someone that they could trust and who they felt was loyal to and committed to the same causes as them, which was, you know, the Easy Beats and AC/DC and so on, they certainly became very close. I spoke to a number of people for this book who'd been friends with Malcolm and George, you know, since the 60s, a long, long time. They stayed close to the people that they really trusted.
And we're speaking today with Jeff Apter, who is the author of an exciting new book called Friday on My Mind, The Life of George Young. Jeff, at about this stage of the program, we ask our guests if they'd like to pick a song. Now, I think your song's probably going to be pretty obvious.
It is. And there's a good backstory to it as well. Friday on My Mind is, for those who don't know, is being constantly selected over a series of years as the number one Australian rock song of all time. Came out in 1966 when the Easy Beats had gone to the UK. They were in a fairly difficult situation. They needed to come up with a hit pretty quickly because a couple of releases upon their arrival in the UK had flopped. They were working in the studio with a well-known producer, an American guy called Shel Talmy, who'd worked with The Who and The Kinks. He had quite a good track record. He said to them, "There's something about this song I really like. Can you go away and work on it?" And Harry and George went off to the cinema to skive off for the afternoon. And before the main feature, there was a documentary on a French a cappella group called the Swingle Sisters. And they specialised in all that, you know, dee-dee-dee-da-da-da, all that kind of almost scatting style singing. And it was exactly, they realised that's exactly what we need for our song. And if you listen to Friday on My Mind, you'll hear traces of that kind of a cappella scat singing, and it really does complete the song, and it became a huge international hit.
Monday morning feels so bad. Everybody seems to nag me. Coming Tuesday, I feel better. Even my old man looks good.
That was Friday on My Mind, as specially chosen for us today by our guest, Jeff Apter. Jeff is the author of a new book called Friday on My Mind, The Life of George Young. And as Jeff mentioned, that song, in 2001, was voted by APRA as the best and most significant Australian song of the previous 75 years. So, yeah, a pretty good song.
It won the stands the test of time, too. Bruce Springsteen, when he came here in 2014, he opened a lot of his Australian shows with Friday on My Mind. So that's 50 years down the line, and the song still had significance for someone as big a player as Bruce Springsteen. So it really means a lot.
Now, Jeff, you mentioned that when they went to England that George changed his songwriting partner. He went from the singer, Stevie Wright, to the guitarist, Harry Vanda. Why did you think he did that?
I think Harry was a more sophisticated musician than Stevie. If you listen to the early Easy Beat songs, and they're all great until that She's So Fine and Sorry and Wedding Ring, I'll Make You Happy, or those songs that George did co-write with Stevie, they're a lot more basic. They're just, you know, a few chords, great chorus, some terrific playing. Stevie sings the heck out of them all, but they're not especially sophisticated. Sorry, when George and the band got to the UK in 66, this is an incredible time in contemporary music and popular music. You know, the Beatles were hitting their stride with Revolver and Rubber Soul. The Rolling Stones were starting to move a little bit beyond being just a blues-loving British rock band. You had bands like Cream about to emerge. The Moody Blues were having hits. The Who was starting to develop as a real songwriting force, not just a creator of hit singles. You know, Pete Townsend, starting to become a very big figure in contemporary music. You had, even the Bee Gees were about to emerge in the UK. So you had all these really fast-developing artists. Songs were getting way beyond the old Moon, June, Spoon kind of concepts. You know, psychedelia was starting to have a bit of an impact on music. So I think Harry has been a musician back in Holland before he came to Australia. He played in a pretty successful band called the Starfighters. So he had good musical chops. The only thing really holding Harry back at the start was the fact that his English wasn't particularly strong. He had to work on that and really be confident with English before he could sit down and start really writing with George. And once that happened, and Stevie, his biographer, said to me, I said, why do you think Stevie stopped writing songs when they went to the UK? And he said he was more interested in smoking pot and chasing girls.
That sums it up, I think.
It kind of sums it up. He was a young guy out front of a band that, once they had a hit with Friday On My Mind, became very much in demand. The Temptations were all there, and they were pretty hard to resist. But yeah, George and Harry, I guess, shared a more serious outlook on music. You know, they wanted, even by, you know, 67, 68, George was saying in interviews, you know, I can see this band lasting a little while longer, but then Harry and I really want to get into songwriting and producing. So he always had ambition that I think extended beyond the simple formula of their early songs and even beyond the easy beats themselves.
And then they had that lucky break when they arrived in England that pirate radio was just starting to take off.
Yeah, and also a lot of expat Aussie DJs like Alan Freeman and people like that who worked on those pirate ships, on those pirate stations. So they were always going to give a leg up to an expat Aussie band. And that's another interesting thing about the Easy Beats. While it featured two Dutchmen, two Poms and a Scot, they were proudly Australian. They knew that Australia had made them because of that migrant hostel connection, you know, and also the fact that they formed there, they started playing there, they had their first success there, and they always proudly considered themselves an Australian band, to the point that when they play overseas, the drummer, Snowy Fleet, would have a little Australian flag planted on his drum kit just to remind people of where they were from. So, you know, that was interesting too. You know, George never said, I'm a Scot. He'd always say, you know, or he would say, I'm Scottish, but we're an Australian rock band. That's who we are.
Now, despite that enormous success of the Easy Beats on with Friday On My Mind, George had some regrets about his time with the band, and I guess he would have passed those lessons on to when his brothers formed AC/DC.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. What happened was, subsequent to Friday On My Mind, in that tempo of the times, everybody was pumping out a hit song seemingly every couple of months. You know, the Beatles would be releasing four, maybe five great songs, the singles in a year. And the Easy Beats knew that they had to keep up with that. And after the success of Friday On My Mind, they made great attempts to, not so much replicate it, but to capture that magic. There were songs like Heaven and Hell and so on. But they were really, in George's mind, and this is only in hindsight, he realized that they were trying too hard to be too many things. They took in a lot of different influences, like so many bands at that time did, that weren't writing hit singles. I guess the big difference between, say, the Easy Beats and the Beatles is, while the Beatles were very experimental, if you listen to Sgt. Pepper's, they were still writing songs that you could play on the radio. the fact that Strawberry Fields and Penny Lane came out at around the same time as Sgt. Pepper's and were separate to the album, that says so much about their strength, both as artists, but as commercial songwriters. And George and Harry just couldn't quite recreate the magic of Friday On My Mind. A little later, they had a couple of great singles in Good Times and St. Louis, and while they were moderate hits, they reminded George of what they should have been doing a couple of years earlier, which was probably stripping things back a little bit, not trying to be so experimental, just writing good, accessible, catchy pop songs that they could play, you know, at a flourish or two here and there, but not to try to be too different and too eclectic. George often said, I don't think people couldn't really grasp what the Easy Beats were because there was no single definable quality to them, no single definable sound. So what happened? Fast forward a few years, and George is working with his younger brothers in AC/DC, and he said to him early on, you know, should we be doing more musically? And he said, no. He said, that's the big mistake that we made in the Easy Beats. He said, you've got your sound. And, of course, the AC/DC sound was the sound of Aussie pubs, you know, that pub rock sound, loud and raw and really in your face and well-played, too. They were really good musicians. And George said, stick with it because you're so lucky you've captured that early on. And, you know, as history's proved the next 40 years, AC/DC kept sticking at it and sold hundreds of millions of records in the process. So it was some pretty damn good advice he gave them.
So maybe the idea was, if you want to experiment and have some variety, and you'd have to say that George Young has plenty of variety in his songwriting catalogue, maybe the idea is you use the specific band for that particular song.
Or you bury it away on the album somewhere. Mm. You know, you can have your album tracks where that's a bit more experimental. But always, you know, if you look at the early AC/DC records, they always had a really good ear for a catchy melody. High Voltage, Dirty Deeds, Long Way to the Top, they're great, catchy pop rock songs, and a lot of that was George's influence. He would sit Malcolm and Angus at the piano and say, what do you got that's new? And if it could fly at the piano, if we can play it on the piano and it works, let's go into the studio and record it. So the idea of, you know, three young brothers, all known for their proficiency on, you know, rock and roll guitarists, sitting at the piano playing, I don't know, Highway to Hell or something, it's an odd picture, isn't it? It's unlikely, but that was George's litmus test. You know, if it flew on the piano, it was worth recording.
You just look at the catalogue of songs that George has written, Evie, Yesterday's Hero, Hey St. Peter, Bad Boy for Love, It's a Long Way to the Top, and of course, going right back to Friday on My Mind, it's an incredible catalogue, and I think maybe people don't realise that he had his hand in so many songs, but your book brings it all out, which is it's fantastic that George gets that recognition, I think.
Yeah, I mean, he was one of the early multitaskers, wasn't he? He and Harry were dab hands at a number of musical styles. The fact that they could be in the studio with AC/DC one day and the next they'd be working with William Shakespeare or John Paul Young and really not seem to have any issue crossing such wide musical gulfs. Sometimes I think, and I was asked about this recently, and sometimes I think the problem is more in the people who assess the music. I remember as a reviewer, I was always amazed, oh my God, they're good at more than one style. Well, that's my own limitation, really more than theirs, thinking, oh, if you're good at one thing, that's all you're good at. And George and Harry were incredibly adept at rock, pop, you know, and when I say pop, I mean quite cheesy, countdown-friendly pop, as well as quality stuff later on with Flash in the Pan, who were a bit avant-garde, a bit ahead of their time. And George and Harry were also interested in things like tape loops, which was the days before sampling, was considered quite progressive approach to recording in the studio. So they had a lot of chops. They just understood a broad range of music, and they were really adept at a lot of different styles.
We could swap stories, I'm sure, about rock and roll, about the Easy Beats, George Young in particular, but unfortunately we've run out of time today. So I'd like to give a special thank you to our guest, Jeff Apter, the author of Friday on My Mind, The Life of George Young. Jeff, thank you very much for being on Dad's on the Air once again.
Always a pleasure, Bill. Thanks very much for the invite.
And don't forget, we'd love to hear from any of our listeners. You can go to our website, dadsontheair.com.au, send us an email and we'll be in touch. If you'd like to listen to this show again or any of our shows, go to our website, dadsontheair.com.au, or you can follow us on Facebook or Twitter. And we'll be back next week with another show on Dad's on the Air.